Cool. So this first slide doesn't work. So it's supposed to be a fancy animation, but naturally, being a computer engineer, I can't make these things go. Right, so that's who I am. Maybe you know that from the fact you're here. The way I structured this talk, actually, it kind of came from last year when I was at SkyCon. I was asked to go down, and Craig, who also works in DemoWare with me, helped me in the kind of a rush job before we went out and got pissed the night before. Throw some stuff together, which is basically all the embarrassing facts you could figure out regarding our use of open source technology, which ended up, came up with quite a few. So basically I've refined that over the last year in various talks into this, which is a bit more broad. Last year we focused on open source and our use of that, which is mainly our Matchmaking Plus product, which is kind of like Xbox Live for PlayStation 3. It was our second product that we made, and it's a server-based system where game clients connect with to discover games, keeps track of friends lists, tracks gameplay statistics, and that kind of stuff. This presentation starts off way back 5 years ago when we started DemoWare, and it talks more about, at the start at least, about the peer-to-peer networking, basically client-to-client networking that we did for games. So, and in a way, it's kind of couched as like an entire history of the company, what we started off thinking we'd do, how we first learned, you know, that it was a bad idea, and kind of all the iterations we made over that. As I go through, please feel free to ask questions at any point. I'm very happy that, unlike last year, this talk isn't on at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. No, that wasn't fun. I see you remember to get me two bottles of water, nonetheless, which is... Okay. Oh, I can fill in the gaps then.
It's supposed to work.
Yeah, and being color and stuff. Well, it's kind of. Yeah. Cool. So, yeah. DemoWare, for anyone who doesn't know, I don't really know if people know who we are now or not. That's changed over the last few years. But we started off basically mainly as students in Trinity College at the very, very start. And I was doing a PhD in networking, and Dylan, the business guy, was just finishing his final year project on the games industry and kind of way the business works. And we already had a small little college company together doing a text messaging portal. That was, still kind of new at the time, the idea. But it wasn't very exciting nonetheless, so we wanted to do something new. And we knew a lot of the guys from Havoc, who'd started up in 1998. And had, like, for instance, been a lot of my lecturers during college would have been people who ended up in Havoc. So we, like, frankly, decided to copy what they were doing, their business model, but not do physics, do networking instead. So that's essentially what we do. We create C++ libraries. We sold them to game studios before we were bought by Activision last year, which is written down there. We previously worked with just about all of the main publishers of games. Ubisoft was probably our biggest customer, and we had an exclusive license for all of their games, for all multiplayer stuff they were doing. We were there. And Codemasters and THQ and so on. Activision is probably our second biggest customer, and they ultimately bought us. What we sold were C++ libraries. That was it. That was the product. So kind of invisible, very hard to explain to anyone who isn't a programmer, and that was one of the greatest challenges at the start. So this is kind of out of date. 25 staff and payroll. Craig, do you know? It's more than that. And Dublin and Vancouver. Dublin is the main development base. Vancouver is the main support base, being in the right time zone, and the coolest city we could find in that time zone. this is kind of what became known as throughout the games industry, as basically a garage company in Dublin, trying to break into a major international industry focused on the West Coast and around California. It's very hard to make our name known. And also, we didn't have much money. We got VC funding when we started in 2003. And we raised €500,000 after about a year's work going around. The dot-com bubble had just burst, and I think we were probably the only people who got anything that year. That's all we had to work on. Equivalent companies in America would have started off with $10 million seed funding, for instance. So guerrilla marketing was really our only tactic. And a Randy French guy designed this for us, and we put it on T-shirts and brought hundreds of them stuffed into different suitcases. A bunch of us flew over to LA for the Games Developer Conference and started handing them out. And that was kind of the start of when well, that's how we first became known, I suppose, as the T-shirt guys. We always thought we should really, we got the domain name demonwear.com as well, so we really should put that to use someday. So that's the timeline of kind of outlined. When we started off, I was still plugging away my PhD, hoping to do the next revolutionary file sharing protocol. And I never thought this company thing would take off. But Dylan is unstoppable. He did get the funding, and I dropped out of the PhD. We took some guys out of the DSG, is the research group in Trinity, distributed systems research group that we were in. And we poached some guys out of there to start with, and then grew from there. Subsequent hires were mainly from NetSoc and Trinity, which we knew best, but as we kind of, the time difference from us leaving Trinity grew, and we became less in touch, and we spread the net a bit wider. And more recently, we've hired a lot of guys from over here, and some people from DCU as well. None from UCD, which is just strange. I don't think they've ever even applied. so that's a picture of the team. It's drinking. I was trying to pretend that's a normal day in the office, but actually that's when we moved out of our office on Middle Abbey Street in Dublin, when we got new offices from Activision, and we went in there at 2 a.m. one day with a bunch of takeaway beer from the local off-license and thrashed the place, which was fun. So kind of what I'm going to outline here is what we first thought the idea was. When we put together the business plan, I went around pitching it to investors who knew much better than to invest in a student company that was pre-product. And trying to do something very adventurous. And this was the adventurous idea. So this came from trying to basically mash up the idea of games and peer-to-peer networks of the time, which were like most popular ones were Kazaa and Morpheus, which basically both used the same protocol underneath, the Fast Track protocol, it was called, and used this two-tier peer-to-peer kind of hybrid topology, where fast, good connection peers would become super peers automatically in the network. They'd directly connect to each other, and low bandwidth peers would directly connect in a client-server kind of way just to one of the super peers. It made it more scalable because you didn't get low bandwidth bottlenecks in the network, which is where Nutella, the previous kind of generation of peer-to-peer stuff, had fallen down. So we thought, if we take that kind of topology and try to mash games into it, where do we get to? And what we thought is, well, we could potentially do something. And I'll go into a little bit of detail of how that plan was supposed to work in a second. But the idea was, we thought, if we look at massively multiplayer online games, which is the first thing anyone getting into like network games is thinking of, that they all want to be the next World of Warcraft or EverQuest. So we naturally did as well. We thought that the most expensive thing for those games is running all the servers. So Blizzard, I speculate, this isn't privileged information because Activision isn't merged with them yet, but I suspect that they spend a large proportion of their huge revenue every month paying for their servers and for their bandwidth. So we thought if we could take all of that and distribute it out in a peer-to-peer sense, well then it's going to be a big win for all of the massively multiplayer people and they'll want to buy our product. Yeah, with that mind, we were thinking of like an arbitrarily, infinitely scalable peer-to-peer network for games. And we also thought that, you know, maybe if that didn't work, we could look at like just kind of session-based games like Battlefield 1942, which were still just plain client-server games like Quake or whatever, but the maps had grown so large that, but the servers were still just servers, that if you get maybe like a 32 or even a 64-player game, of which there were very few people willing to pay for the kind of servers to host a 64-player Battlefield game, you'd still spend most of your time running around trying to find someone to shoot because the maps were so large. So I thought, well, maybe we could help out there as well. So, how we started. So, I suppose it's nearly exactly 5 years ago now that we kind of sat down in that office I showed earlier and tried to figure out how to put it together. We were mainly from DSG at the start in Trinity, the research group that spawned Iona, which was, I suppose, one of the first companies to use the term middleware about 15 years ago, mainly for banks, though, and like enterprise-level kind of networking software with using Corba. So I don't think many people really know what Corba is anymore. No, some maybe.
Everyone knows what it is.
That could be it. A lot of people, when I give this, they don't know what it is, even in master's courses around the place. So I just say it's like Java, RMI, or whatever, or SOAP. But anyway, so we thought that would be a great place to start. And, you know, the buzzwords associated with Corba is, you know, scalable, efficient, you know, stable, small, lightweight, all that kind of good stuff. So we thought, well, naturally, you know, and we naturally have to use it, being from where we are, and, you know, with the feeling that we could trade in the reputation. So we started off thinking we were just going to take this free implementation, which is the ASORB, called Tau, which is basically just an open source thing run by some lecturing university in America, and use that for games. And basically, we're just going to take this piece of open source software, put our name in it, and sell it for megabucks to game studios. When we started trying to get this to work, we just instantly started running into issues, one of which was that, it's not efficient, like they say. Every single request has a GUID in there, which is 128 bytes. That's about the four times the size that you want a single game packet to be, and you've only just identified the packet. Porting this software around to PlayStation 2, to PSP, to Xbox, was just an unknown challenge. I mean, exactly how this kind of big, gnarly piece of kind of open source bloatware would have actually survived on those platforms is something we didn't know anything about. Memory overhead was also an unknown. This thing's designed to run on servers. We were trying to design it to make something run on a fixed size memory device, like a PlayStation, PlayStation 2 anyway, where every K counts. And overall, I'll skip to the last one there, which is firewalls and NATs. I'm going to come back to that one. There's another thing we knew basically nothing about when we started. It just generally wasn't a concern, even though we were networking people, supposedly. But yeah, major issues. And it kind of goes then to the second last point, maybe they should be flipped, is that generally speaking, Corba, and you could say all of its kind of all the similar technologies out there, like, you know, SOAP, they're designed for enterprise-level applications running in a client-server context, where the server is a properly dedicated hosted machine running in a data center somewhere with a real IP address that's publicly readable on the internet. Games, on the other hand, are generally run by people in their homes. Those machines in the homes are running behind a home ADSL router that has some kind of twisted kind of NAT implementation in there. They don't have much bandwidth. Their bandwidth's asymmetrical, and essentially the environment's completely different. So we realized we're just going down the wrong way. So we managed to waste a couple of months at the start with that before we completely backed off, realized the first mistake, and decided to throw Ace away, which was something we never told investors because the business plan was completely based around it. they didn't mind in the end. They made lots of money back. So, yeah. This orb we were using, this Tau, the ACE orb, was based on basically a kind of transport layer, this open source transport layer called ACE, or it's really a set of C++ frameworks for designing network applications. And the orb is built on top of that. So we decided to strip away the orb and just try using the layer underneath, which was rational, I suppose, at the time. And then we realized that just because something's open source doesn't mean it's good. It was very, very hard to work with as a piece of software. So we managed to waste yet more time trying to write essentially a wrapper around this piece of software, trying to figure this huge, huge piece of software, badly documented, but lots of code. And that's what coders will do if given the opportunity. You know, they'll create lots and lots of code, but never really describe what any of it does. And instead of actually refactoring existing code, they'll add new code. And that's basically seemed to be where this thing had ended up. So even figuring out where to start was hard. And then it got to the point where we realized, because we've been reading stuff on the internet, that we, for games, anyway, we needed to be using UDP and not TCP. Do people know what the difference is? Some people, but anyway, yeah. So UDP is like TCP with the top stripped off, all the reliability taken away. So essentially we had this huge library linked in, and we're using none of its fancy shit at all. We were just trying to get it to open the socket, and then we're trying to go back down underneath the software and find that socket, pull it out, and use it directly. Which just meant it was pointless. So we realized that being network people, we probably had to figure out how to do networking ourselves and start from scratch. So essentially using starting from the BSD sockets kind of level interface and working up. So this is where we really started in earnest. There was a guy in the company who would actually he used to work in Havoc and started with us directly afterwards. And he was, I suppose, the best coder of the lot of us. Because he actually had real industry experience, and we just had masters and PhDs and stuff like that, which turned out to really count for nothing. So he taught us a lot about actually writing code that doesn't crash and is readable. He also, well, this is going on the website, so maybe I'll flick over. He managed to find a coding standard from somewhere, which really helped us along at the start. And yeah, this one thing I didn't know when I started was the importance of a coding standard in a team. If all code really has to be approachable by anyone in the team, and people's unique flair should really not be visible in it. And it should, and just you could say, just for the sake of complete consistency, all code should be written identically. But also, just so you know, everyone feels like they can approve anything, and they don't need to say, "Oh well, we can't fix that anymore. That guy decided to become, you know, a software developer in an investment house in London. You know, that's stuck now." So, yeah, we took that coding standard, and we began to write our own transport layer. So what this was about was starting from a single UDP socket open through the socket interface and building layers up there to try to handle the problems inherent with UDP. I realize so far I haven't really justified why we're using UDP instead of TCP, which is what is used for 99% of all network applications nowadays, but I'll go into that in a little bit. So since we're using UDP, there's a lot of layers you have to build up there. UDP has no reliability, packets get lost. There's no guarantees about, you won't know they got lost. Just fire them out, hope for the best. There's security issues as well. So we had to kind of reinvent those mechanisms that exist in TCP in your stack already and put them into UDP, or put them into a library on top of UDP. But it had advantages that we were going to reap the benefits of, which is, in a way, you can get better performance. That's a kind of weird thing to say, but what it really means is with UDP, you get more control over what happens with your traffic. It's not like you're sending this packet and it might get dropped, and if it gets dropped, the stack will just do stuff to make it, like, get it across again and keep on resending it. And you have no control of it, over it. Once you send something through TCP, that's going to happen. Stuff will get dropped and then it'll try to recover it. That recovery can take a very long time. You know, it gets dropped, has to detect it through a timeout, gets retransmitted. So that, you know, one lost packet can, to the application at the other end, look like, you know, latency just spiked up to a couple of seconds. So that's really what performance means. With UDP, you can make your own decisions regarding, well, with this piece of data, this is only meaningful for about 100 milliseconds anyway, so I'm not going to do this other stuff. I'm just going to fire it. If I lose it, well, that's the best case anyway. You know, at least I don't waste a couple of seconds trying to get something old back. So that's what performance means in that context. And NATs and firewalls, that's the other thing. You can't get TCP peer-to-peer connections working in the real world because of NATs and firewalls, but you can get UDP, peer-to-peer, so-called connections, or at least traffic flows working. So yeah, we said one guy who was, one guy, Dave, was really good at just completely taking control of that, reading all of the RFCs out there and basically re-implementing network stack on top of UDP, or all the reliability aspects anyway. The rest of us focused on what to do once we had that transport there, how to create the peer-to-peer overlay topology, which is what we would normally call it to distinguish it from physical topology involving wires and routers and so on. So yeah, I mentioned Kazaa and Morpheus before. We were looking to do a two-tier topology. The super peers would really be the traditional game server, like Quake or whatever. You know, the server's in control of the world. Clients who send traffic to it, it sends traffic back saying what happened. So we wanted essentially lots of these servers and hook them all up so that they could share the burden of managing the game world. The smart bit, and the bit that we felt was the coolest bit, was the last one. We wanted to make all of the overlay topology, the connections in this overlay topology, I have a diagram in the middle, kind of spatially correspond to the game world. So maybe I'll just find this diagram. Ah, yes, cool. The embarrassing bit, I don't know the timing of this. This is actually really, really corny. We gave this, I cut this out of a presentation that we gave to an extremely rich venture capital company that were a little bit shocked when they saw they were actually just meeting a bunch of like 23-year-olds in 2003. So I winced when I copied this out initially. So imagine this is a landscape in a game, and these are positions of the players. And we split it into a grid, and it gets divided into regions somehow. Maybe because players running around starts with one and then it kind of splits up as they run around, but we do some kind of thing. So we introduce, basically each server would be in charge of one part of the world and they hook up like that. So each server also forms a direct connection through our software to any servers adjacent to it or that have responsibility for adjacent areas in the game. And where's the smart bit? So, I'm sure I had the time for this down pat, like I'm giving this investor presentation. Yeah, so that guy did something very strange. I don't know where he went. But there we go, he's back. So the idea was some player moves and it goes to the server and an update needs to be sent. That server processes, sometime later sends an update to the adjacent servers. They pass it on. I don't know what happened there either. Okay. This is what happens when you copy and paste between PowerPoints, open office documents, back and forward over several years. But you kind of get the gist. Those little things are supposed to be updates. They're not supposed to come from the sky. They're supposed to be passed around. But anyway, the gist is that we get to make a very cool trade-off there. The last player to find out where that player is moving is the one furthest away on the map, and that's the last player to really care about it. Right. So this allows us to split up the game into all these sections and split up the burden of managing it. Everyone doesn't need to know about everything all of the time. Instead, you know, the guy who's furthest away is going to find out last about things. He's least latency sensitive. He doesn't care about the fact it took, you know, 5 or 6 hops to get to him. And that kind of optimizes on latency. And in terms of bandwidth, it's not really demonstrated, but you know, as that update went out, they'd be coming from other places as well. Say this guy has got a bunch of updates coming in. When he's amalgamating all of these and passing them on, he can kind of mash them all together into one big packet, thereby saving bandwidth. Because every packet has a header. And in games, the headers can end up taking up more space than the actual game data. It can happen very easily. So game data might be, you know, 30 bytes. You just want to get these 30 bytes to its destination fast, so you want to send them now. But the UDP header is 28 bytes, and that's not saying anything about the IP header underneath that and any other headers in like the physical protocols you're using, Ethernet frames or whatever. So you can actually end up very easily in a real-time application like that spending all of your bandwidth on headers. So if you can mush lots of data into one big packet, so you have 15 updates of 30 bytes in one packet and just one header, then you really win. Anyway, we thought that was fucking cool. And we actually built a prototype. And I was shocked when I actually looked this up. We managed to build a prototype in about 5 months, which I thought was great. Very surprising, considering where we started. Those 5 months, to me, looking back, seemed like there were maybe 18 months, considering the amount of stuff we managed jamming there in terms of learning experiences. So this working prototype was kind of dodgy. It crashed a bit. Weird stuff could happen in it. And it involved what we called fly demo, because we took a little OpenGL example with a paper plane flying around. And we split we kind of ended up re-engineering it entirely, but the concept existed. We just split the world into two sections, had a server for each section. And then we'd have clients could join in. They'd end up joining one server, each of the plane, and they could fly around. They could fly from one server to another server seamlessly. They could shoot missiles and stuff across the two sections of the world as well. But it looked seamless to the user. Let's see. So object migration was smooth. Some of you might be thinking that already about race conditions and what happens if these updates are passing between servers. Doesn't that give people greater opportunities to, say, mutually shoot each other or create kind of weird paradoxical situations in the game? And the fact is, yeah, it does. But that kind of happens anyway in games. So we took this demo on the road. It only crashed occasionally. And we, myself and Dylan, we flew over to all of these studios and other middleware companies in America. We were very sure. Here's a piece of information. They never get visitors, and they're delighted to have anyone call at the door. So two young Irish lads carrying 6 laptops to Wisconsin. It's just a treat for them. So we carried it in. So here's a little trip. I had fun making this little PowerPoint thing. So we took that big trip. And this is the first kind of course, first showing to who we were hoping would be our core market of our cool new technology. And their reaction was actually, that's cool, great. We're still just trying to get 8-player games running. Could you help us with that instead? So we realized we had, at that point, we became suspicious anyway, that at least the studios we saw either knew how to solve the networking problem already because they were like Raven and had done Soldier of Fortune and stuff like that. Or they were other studios who were mainly console focused and were just trying to get into networking for the first time and were still struggling with just 8 players and had no interest in something that could scale them up to several thousand. So we realized we could kind of do this. Oh, that's kind of all weird as well. But kind of, yeah, this is what our topology looked like, and maybe we could salvage something by taking most of it away, leaving ourselves with a client-server topology, something very similar to what's in Quake or Half-Life or Battlefield. And just make a very good... we thought to ourselves we could take those techniques, make one C++ library that just is a really solid implementation of those techniques. We could sell that potentially as, you know, just here's something, it'll cost a few $1,000 and it'll save you a lot of development time and risk in your project. So we went along those lines. We essentially copied Quake. But, you know, John Carmack open sourced it, so he can't be too angry over it. It's flattery. And Quake's, I'm not sure if you know, you can download the source code. I think you can even download source code to Quake 3 now. They only keep, I think, the last generation of it, of the engine, completely closed source. And the artwork, and download, yeah, the engines, or at least used to be, I haven't looked at it in a while, was in two halves. There's the core engine, and then it loads up a DLL, which is kind of the game part. So it's the engine part and the game part. And I think they open source the game part to allow modders to get in there and so on. And they open source the engine then a couple of years later. Anyway, Quake is, at that time, I suppose, like one of the most popular online games. And also any other popular online games tended to be derived off that code base. Like the kind of family tree for Quake is stunning. You know, I saw someone had it once. I'm not sure if it was Activision or if it was just on the internet. But you kind of have, you know, Doom, and then a little line going down, and you get, like, Quake. And then a little line, it goes into Quake World, which is, you know, kind of community kind of went in there and said, we're going to add networking to this, internet networking to this LAN-only game. And from Quake World, it starts just exploding out. You get all the Quakes, then you get everyone the engine was licensed to. Valve licensed that for Half-Life. You get all the Half-Life derivatives coming out of there. And essentially, there's so many games derived off that code base. Anyway, it's good. We decided to take those techniques and just jam them into one library. let's see. Yeah, and it worked. Yeah, we did a joint demo with Renderware, who were another middleware company at the time. Owned by Criterion, which was bought by EA then, and that acquisition, at least in terms of the middleware part, the renderer part, apparently didn't really work out very well for them. But anyway, we did a joint demo, and it was very cool. It was a first-person shooter, and we had a crazy Russian intern do it for us, and he did an amazing job. It turned out to perform better than Quake, which we were happy with in the end. So, let's see. I think the next bit is kind of like an opportunity I could go into a little bit in terms of how that kind of client-server topology works, actually, if you like, or I can just skip on and keep it going. We might be constrained for time, I'm not sure. It's supposed to finish at about 4:30? Less time. All right. So anyway, I'll be brief. Client-server, I don't know why I have Xboxes at all. That doesn't make sense. They send in their UDP packets up to the server, basically inputs, actions. I'm running forward, I jumped, I shot a gun. That kind of stuff. That's all clients do. They send it to the server. Server picks it up over, you know, a certain amount of time, maybe 100 milliseconds, and say in Quake 2 is what it did. So server only ever processed things 10 times a second. Clients would send stuff up 20 times a second, just basically, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. The server would pick it up, run it all through the simulation loop, figure out all the results were, which means, okay, you fell off the edge of something, you're actually in this new position, you got shot. Basically the state, as we would call it, and the server sends that back down to the client. And in between, there's a lot of cool techniques employed to try and disguise the fact that when you press, say, jump in Quake, that it's actually only really happens, you know, a fraction of a second later after it's actually got sent to the server. Maybe that takes 200 milliseconds. Then the server, it might be 100 milliseconds later the server actually does anything about it. Then it's another few hundred milliseconds before it comes back to you. And that's a very visible delay on screen. If you take all of the optimizations, basically the prediction techniques on the client out, it's very, very hard to play. It's like you're playing the game in skates. But you can do these predictive techniques. Basically, the client assumes that if I say I jumped, I probably did jump. I can just update my position. And only very occasionally, maybe 1% or 2% of the time, does the server have something different to say. So that's kind of what happens. The details were actually very, very complicated. It took us a long time to develop this client-server library. And the sad part was that I never got used in any games after all of that work. Except for last year, when a studio we didn't even know was developing, but it just came out with a game that had it in it. So we thought, wow, we must have actually done a good job back then if we created a product so good it didn't even need proper documentation or any support to use. Soldier of Fortune 3. Yeah. Which wasn't Raven. Do you remember the name of the studio?
I don't actually know. Some Eastern European crowd.
Yeah. Okay, so what's this bit talking about? Yeah, just a couple of things about servers, right? This goes into why client server didn't work. For us, like servers in these games, it could be hosted. Like a lot of Battlefield 2 servers and Quake, say Quake Wars servers, we were involved in Quake Wars, so you know this well, are hosted in data centers, they're properly hosted. But in other client server games, like say Halo 2, the server is just another console in someone's home. And actually, this point isn't on this slide, but yeah, it's the most important one now. Oh, it is, upstream bandwidth. If you're hosting something from home, most people have ADSL connections, which means that they have got, you know, a huge amount of download capacity, but very, very small upload capacity. So the server has the hardest job in terms of sending out all the state to everyone. It has to continuously send everything to everyone, basically. It's kind of got an N-squared kind of order, N-squared kind of thing going on there. So whenever you have a server that isn't hosted in a data center, that becomes your main bottleneck in terms of the number of players you can get on. So if you only got 256K upload, that doesn't equate to very many players, which is why in a game like Halo 2, you don't get that many players. I mean, the maximum session size, I think, is 12 players or something that game, something like that. On the flip side, you could host it if you want, like Battlefield servers or Quake servers or whatever, but that turns into like a very expensive proposition for a games publisher. You know, just to allow people to pay, they're going to now spend $500,000 a year on servers, you know, just so, it just doesn't make sense to them, so they don't. Anyway, that's a big cost, but with client server, it's for PC especially, it's more robust against attack. You know, you can really only properly attack the server. You can do some stuff in the client, like, you know, make all the walls transparent by hacking your drivers and so on, but you can't really do anything like, I just killed everyone. There's no kind of cheat for that, except unless you're actually running the server. So client server is favored on PC because of that. Let's see, where are we going to go here? I'll pick that up in a second after this. We hopped over to the game that says 2004 over there, Games Developer Conference 2004, first big conference. We realized that we weren't alone. There were lots of middleware companies. They were all strangely also focusing on massively multiplayer stuff, much like we were hoping to. We didn't really have, at that point, a client-server demo. I think the chronology is wrong here, but we didn't have that renderware client-server thing quite ready. Or if we did, we weren't really pushing it. We're still trying to see if we could get somewhere with this massively multiplayer stuff, because like everyone, we think that's the coolest stuff that's out there. So lots of companies displaying their wares. There were no customers between us all, so far as we could tell, but people were happy to have meetings, and they were very, very polite. And we just kind of realized that, you know, massively multiplayer stuff. We just had this brainwave. This is why you should always do market research before you start a company, not waste a year. Massive multiplayer games might be cool, but you know, there's not a lot of them. And there isn't really very much room for many of them in the world. And the ones that are there like last a long time. It's not like a new one comes out like every month or every Christmas or whatever, or a new group of them. So at the moment, of course, it's World of Warcraft, and it doesn't look like it's about to get knocked off top position. So basically, first of all, there just aren't many of them, and they don't turn over very quickly. And secondly, the people who make those games tended to get into it because they really liked networking and wanted to solve that hard problem for themselves. So we realized we had a small market that wasn't interested in buying anything at that conference. We realized, okay, away with multi-server demo, the hybrid peer-to-peer stuff, and we just had to focus on client server. But we had another terrible realization, which was the client server is cool, and what we created worked, as evidenced by that studio that sneakily integrated it into Soldier Fortune 3 last year. But that it's generally unsuitable for console games, because, you know, every console is identical. People have more or less the same kind of bandwidth. Who's going to be the server in that relationship? You know, you could do it, but you're not making best use of the network. And console games are basically 85% of the games market. We all came from a PC background, like probably most of you people, but it's not most of the people who buy games. So client server just wasn't really cutting it. And most people on PC already had client their networking sorted out, because they bought Quake, the Quake engine, they bought the Unreal Engine, they bought in an engine that already had it, so they just wouldn't need to buy it. So we realized we had to do something else. So we decided to go back to peer-to-peer, all the way back to peer-to-peer. So this time it was going to be a little bit different. Basically, we were going to go for a straight peer-to-peer topology. And this, every player connects to every other player. And the first thing that us networking people, or at least with the kind of latent collegial bit of our brains from our research group, would have said is, oh, straight peer-to-peer, that's unscalable, that'll never work. But the fact is, and looking at the real problem in front of us, it was the perfect solution. People only wanted a certain number of players in their games. You know, you're talking about session-based games, you know, maybe they want 12 players. It seems like most game designers seem to think that's a really cool thing and have difficulty talking about 24 or 32 players. I mean, they can do it, but often they don't. So we just thought, I'm going to go with straight peer-to-peer. And at this, every console connects to every other console or PC. Every machine is directly connected to each other. And there's two ways this can work. I don't think I discussed the second one, but I'll hear in the slides, but I'll just mention it. One is everyone sends user input to each other, like I did this, basically actions. And then everyone gathers them up, and when everyone has everyone's actions, they put them all together, sort them deterministically, and everyone applies them in the same way. So the game logic proceeds in exactly the same way everywhere. It's essentially a fancy version of postal chess, I think is a very good analogy for it. That's how a bunch of games work, particularly, RTS games tend to work that way, and poker games, that kind of thing. So we started off with that and put a lot of work into it, and it actually worked quite well. We realized that wasn't quite the right answer either, because with that kind of model, one slow machine in the game, someone who's at home and, you know, whose girlfriend is downloading an email attachment and congesting the internet connection, is going to have difficulty getting traffic out. That's going to slow everyone, the whole entire game down, while they all wait for that one person's input. So that kind of topology is, or that model where you do deterministic advancement of the game based on receiving everyone's actions in a kind of, it's called lockstep very frequently, or deterministic peer-to-peer, or synchronous peer-to-peer is another name for it, or I suppose what I'd call it if I wasn't into the whole brevity thing would be an ordered atomic multicast system. So that's cool, but the one not great for a lot of games because of the variability, you know. Anyone can slow, one bad guy slows everyone down. So another way you can do this is not to send actions, but instead to send state. So racing games and first-person shooters and consoles are generally work like this. Everyone connects directly to each other, you know, and basically each console simulates its car, for instance, and is completely responsible for that. So you press the buttons, it drives forward, and at some regular interval, 4 times a second, 10 times a second, it just sends a message to everyone else in the game saying, I'm currently here, I'm currently here, I'm currently here. And so that same guy will be receiving that from everyone and just interpolates between all of the updates, just smooths them out and draws that on screen. That works really well. So, say, Call of Duty 3, which was a game we worked on quite heavily, used the software in that way. First-person shooter, everyone runs around, and only 4 times a second, each player only 4 times a second sends its position to everyone else's machine.
So how do you get the magical people to just teleport from one place to the next in there?
Well, actually, I think with that game, they wouldn't quite teleport as slide. You know, and that's what you do. You know, you're just interpolating between the last two updates you received for everyone, which doesn't mean what you're showing on screen is old. You know, it means that it's representing a position somewhere between the second last update and the last update that you received. But in straight peer-to-peer, the traffic gets everywhere as quickly as it physically can on the internet. Everyone's sending it directly. It's not bouncing through a server or anything. So you kind of have a trade-off there, and it worked well. And that game was well, whatever about the quality of the gameplay, people seem to prefer Call of Duty 2 and Call of Duty 4. The networking of that game was, you know, had accolades and so on, and people said, it's amazing they cracked it. It's lag-free. We liked that one. Because time's running out, I'm just going to gloss over the way it worked. We just reused software. It was very good. We reused the transport layer, a lot of stuff from the client-server stuff, and just kind of rewired the topology and then created new stuff on top of it. The complicated part was that doing a reliable ordered atomic multicast, essentially a group of N nodes trying to send stuff to each other. But you want to make sure that everyone receives all the traffic in exactly the same way so that you can pass it back up to the application saying, here's your set of, you know, data received. But everyone has to pass exactly the same set of data up. Otherwise, each game is going to do something slightly different, and you're going to end up with some kind of butterfly effect happening throughout the game, and the game state's diverging rapidly. So that was quite hard to solve, especially when you consider that someone can disconnect, physically disconnect, halfway through sending data. So now you have some data somewhere. You don't know where, but you might have to recover something. Anyhow, yeah. So we were proud of it. This brought us back to the network address translation thing, the NAT issue, which was tough, very tough, and kind of unexpected. We were kind of putting it long fingers, saying, yeah, we hear there's a problem there, but no one's complained yet. So it was a very late addition into our software. So network address translation is the technology used in home routers and in like various other pieces of hardware and software you can buy, even internet connection sharing or Windows, for instance, to share one internet address, one real internet address that can actually have data sent to it across the internet between a number of devices, because there aren't enough IP addresses to go around anymore. And it does that by creating a little table in memory. So if I'm at home and I make a web request in the router, it remembers that my machine from a particular port sent a piece of traffic to this other machine on the internet at some port. If any traffic comes back from that machine, it just looks at that table and routes it back to where it came from on the inside. That's basically how it works. It's got a fundamental assumption in there that's very inconvenient for anyone who wants to do peer-to-peer stuff, including games, file sharing applications, VoIP, any of that kind of stuff, IM even. The assumption is, it's all built around, and how they pull that trick is the assumption that what machines at home do is make requests. And what machines that are on the other side of the network do is send responses to those requests. That's what it's all about. The router is making an assumption that any data that arrives should be a response to a request that was made by someone on the inside. So that's fine for surfing. It's fine for email. It's fine for nearly anything that normal people would do on the internet. But for peer-to-peer applications, which are becoming more mainstream, you know, games are an obvious example, you know, BitTorrent, or even just, you know, Google Chat or Skype or something like that, it's very inconvenient, because what's happening there is you want to, say, place a call and Skype through to someone else. That person's router is going to get some data arriving to it, and it's going to discard it, because it says that's not a response to anything anyone in here asked for. So it drops it. So the problem of managing, or basically initiating a connection, is very, very hard when you're trying to initiate it to someone behind a router. So you can imagine the difficulty. With peer-to-peer, you have lots of connections. So peer-to-peer in games, without taking steps to get around that stuff, just isn't going to work. So there's various steps you can take. It's still hard. You can't get complete efficiency, but with UDP, at least you have a chance. The reason is that UDP uses one port. Right? So in code, you bind one socket that gets one port from the network stack on your machine, on whatever interface it's bound to. And you can send data to anyone from that port, and anyone can send data to you on that port. Whether it actually gets there or not, because it's UDP, is, you know, not guaranteed. But from software, you just use one port. That means that from the point of view of solving the NAT problems, you can just look at one port number, which has one mapping in the router, and focus on kind of like cracking that open. In contrast with TCP, every connection you open, or every person you send to, gets a new port, right? So, because there's a connection, right? A connection means there's only two ends. So if I want to talk to five people, I need five connections. Each connection gets its own port, which kind of means that you can't. There's nothing to really focus on in terms of trying to crack open the NAT and allow port in traffic in on any particular port, because there's so many of them, and you never know what the next one is going to be. So that's kind of what UDP is good for. With UDP, there's several techniques. One is you have to first of all figure out what your actual address is. If I'm on my home network, my address is some private reserved network address like 192.168. It's not a real internet address. So I have to find out what it really is. That means you have to bounce off a server and get that server to tell you what your actual address is. Now at least you know what your address is. Next, it depends on your actual router, how it's going to handle this network address translation. They tend to get confused, is the problem. Some of them just do that network address translation, as I said, and that's nice. Once you know your external port, it says any traffic coming into this port is going to go back to this guy who initially opened it on the inside. We like those, right? And they would be called full cone NATs or open NATs, as we call them, and how they're called, that's what they're called in Xbox. But some NATs, unfortunately, decide to be firewalls as well and try to perform restrictions on who can send traffic in, not just that they're sending it to the right port on the real internet address that your router has open, but also it checks who it's coming from and whether some data has been sent to that guy recently. That can get kind of complicated. So there is a technique of taking two people behind those kind of NATs and using a server. For instance, we host one of these servers. Stun is the name of the protocol if you want to look it up, and there's some extensions. This is called NAT punching. Basically, if this guy wants to open a connection to this guy, but they can't normally talk to each other, we arrange it so that they both constantly speak to the Stun server. Every 15 seconds, everyone sends a tiny packet to the Stun server, which keeps a little mapping in their routers open, so it doesn't time out. So if this guy wants to talk to this guy, he sends a message to Stun server saying, please introduce me. The Stun server then sends down a message to both of them, which gets in because that mapping to the Stun server is still open, telling them to simultaneously connect to each other. The packets fly across the internet. When they leave the router, they open up mappings to each other, and when they arrive on the other side, they slide right in, and you open the connection. When I visualize it in my head, it's kind of cool. Yeah, so it's coming. The presentation is actually quite long, but it's coming to a nice little point now. So, some other stuff. We got partnered with Xbox and PlayStation's middleware, and we got some deals. And we did a poker game called Stacked, which was lots of fun. Ironically speaking, it was just one of those projects that we were cowboys at the time. We were hired. The studio that made them were maybe, I wouldn't call anyone that if it's going to go on the internet. And it was just incredibly well funded. So it was a bit of a train wreck, the entire project. It just would never stop. Well, that was, and we kind of grew up as a company. We were cowboys at the start, certainly. We were young. We were flying by the seat of our pants. But soon after that, we got a contract with Activision for Call of Duty 2, big red one, the console version, not the popular, the Xbox and PlayStation 2 version, not the popular 360 version. And that was a very big deal to us, and we kind of grew up a lot over that. And we saw this other title, this poker game, hanging over us. Anyway, it all worked well. And this is where I'll stop, because the next bit is the Matchmaking Plus product, which is the hosted online services. That goes on for quite a while, and I kind of talked about it last year anyway. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean, for coming all the way down from Dublin on rather fast-paced talk. And there's a break for 10 minutes and more stuff afterwards.